Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by The Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy Bookshop, your book is waiting.
Hello from the Baltimore Sun, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 383, for Tuesday, May 1st, 2018. Happy May Day, comrades. Our guest today is U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen, Maryland's junior senator. And today, we catch up on a lot of issues. Donald J. Trump, the Trump cabinet, including Scott Pruitt, the administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Van Hollen has called for his resignation, the Republican tax cuts, North Korea, the Iran nuclear deal, and close to home, Van Hollen's efforts to get some federal help for Baltimore as it tries to curtail a long surge of violent crime. Senator, it's nice to see you again. Thanks for visiting us.
Great to be back. Thanks.
You come back here in Baltimore at a time when we're seeing an increase in violence again in the city. I get so dismayed by this. We've had a couple of good months, you know, where shootings were down, the trends were good, and then April hit, and we put it in the newspaper last week as that sense of dread returning, that we're going to see another surge in violence in Baltimore. But this subject of violence in Baltimore came up in the Senate just last week with the Attorney General, and you had a question for him. Let's go over that.
I did, and as you said, we really need a concentrated, comprehensive effort to tackle violence in Baltimore City and other places around the country. And one of the programs that the Justice Department had proposed for cities with high levels of violence was a federal partnership program where people could have federal resources to share expertise on strategies that have been successful in reducing violence. And originally, the Department of Justice reached out to Baltimore City and said, you meet all the conditions that would make you eligible, and let's form a partnership. And the city applied, and then they got from the Department of Justice, well, here's our asterisk, right? In order to qualify, you, Baltimore City, have to make sure you meet all our requirements with respect to immigration policy and the so-called sanctuary cities issue. Now, what I asked Attorney General Sessions about at a hearing just last week was two things. One, Baltimore City doesn't control its detention center. It's a state-run detention center. So putting aside any arguments people have on sanctuary cities for right now, why are you penalizing Baltimore City by not allowing them to have this funding when Baltimore City doesn't control the immigration policies within its detention
center? And why is the detention center so key to this?
Well, because we were looking at Baltimore specifically. And when the Justice Department reviewed these proposals, our view is they disqualified Baltimore because of the, quote, sanctuary city issue. But the reality is Baltimore City, the laws of Baltimore City, have nothing to do with the policies within the Baltimore City Detention Center because that is a state of Maryland-run
right.
institution.
And what Sessions wants, what Immigration Customs Enforcement wants, is the local police to question people that they arrest, right? That they detain.
Right. And they on federal immigration policy, and they want to let them in the jails. But there are two separate issues here. The first is, and the point I made to him was, don't penalize Baltimore City. They don't have any jurisdiction over the laws in their jails. So stop denying them this important resource to help reduce crime. You know, if you want to deal with sanctuary cities, that's a set of Maryland laws, which they're actually not sanctuary city laws, but they're Maryland laws. Second and apart from that is the whole debate over sanctuary cities. And on that front, just in the last couple of weeks, the Seventh Circuit actually found that the Trump administration policy saying that if you, you know, protect immigrants in your area, you're disqualified from what are called burn justice grants. This is another form of assistance. The court said you can't do that. They sort of struck down that condition. So I don't know if the Trump administration is going to appeal, but that would actually provide resources to Baltimore also through the Justice Burn Grant program.
It's badly needed. What exactly do we get out of the public safety partnership if we get it?
Well, on that program, the main thing would be a flood of additional federal resources and support. They send in a team. It's through the U.S. attorney. We now have a new U.S. attorney who replaced Rod Rosenstein. Mm-hmm. The new attorney, U.S. attorney, is a guy, last name of Herr, Robert Herr. And we look forward to working with him on that issue. The other area, of course, where there's some, you know, federal intersection with Baltimore City public safety is the consent.
The consent
agreement.
Decree.
The consent decree, mm-hmm. Which the Trump administration tried to throw out when it first came in. But a judge, Baltimore U.S. District Judge, actually said, no, this is a binding agreement now between the city and the Justice Department. And so we look forward to, you know, working with the city, working with the Justice Department, working with the police department to make sure that that effort moves ahead.
What did you get from Sessions?
Well, the there's the good news and the bad news. I mean, the good news with respect to the Baltimore City and being eligible for these partnership grants and support is that he did pledge to reconsider it based on the fact that I made the point that, you know, again, Baltimore, don't punish Baltimore City for something it has no control of. The issue of whether or not ICE, you know, the Immigration Enforcement, get access to Baltimore City Detention Center and is a state issue, not a Baltimore City issue. So he agreed to take a fresh look at this, and we're going to be pushing ahead in the coming days to try to hold him to it.
And now you have a court decision supporting your position.
So the court position, the court decision is even broader because what the court decision says, no matter where you are, you cannot be disqualified by the Department of Justice for grants because you have in place laws that say that the local police don't have to become ICE agents, and you don't have to turn everybody immediately over to ICE, even if there's a nonviolent kind of violation. Two separate issues. One is with respect to Baltimore City, irrespective of what the laws of the city are, they don't govern that issue. The state laws do. So he should help us on both fronts.
What do you say to people who say at this juncture in this conversation, always say, what part of illegal don't you understand? Why wouldn't Baltimore City want to help us clean up illegal immigrants who are in the United States, get them out of the country?
Well, I do believe if you've got somebody who's committed any kind of violent crime, that in those instances, you should definitely turn them over to ICE and deportation. What we are talking about here are people who have been living in the community for a very long time. Maybe they have a traffic ticket. Maybe they got something else. And to the extent that they get caught up in the criminal justice system and deported, the reality is that means other crimes go unreported, and because of the total distrust within the overall system. And so that is why the state of Maryland, again, not Baltimore City, but the state of Maryland, which does not have a so-called sanctuary cities policy for the state, but they do have a policy that says, you know, we're not going to turn all of our public safety people into ICE agents because we actually think that increases the risk of violent crime going unreported and unpunished.
Speaking of people who've been in the country a long time, there are the Dreamers under DACA. We had a court ruling telling the president that he couldn't reverse DACA on his own. I think basically I'm summarizing it, simplifying the ruling. But what should happen there? What do you think?
Well, we need a permanent solution. Again, these are the Dreamers. These are, you know, folks who were brought here at very young ages, kids, by their parents. The kids didn't violate any U.S. immigration laws, which is why, you know, President Obama established the DACA program. President Trump pulled the plug on the program last September, essentially said that, you know, folks had until the beginning of March of this year to come up with a permanent solution. And then he challenged Congress to come up with a bipartisan solution. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The Senate did come up with a bipartisan solution, Republicans and Democrats. And once everybody did what the president said he wanted a bill of love. He said all these things.
Right.
And then when the bill came out and was presented, he sabotaged it, pulled the plug on it, and the Department of Homeland Security attacked it. So that bill would have passed. It would have had the 60-plus votes in the Senate. So now we're back to where we were, except, as you indicated, a federal judge has said that the administration has not made the case for scrapping the DACA program, that they can't arbitrarily just get rid of it without any justification. So as of now, it's at that court level, and unless the administration comes up with an adequate justification, according to this judge, not only are people who are currently on DACA protected, but people who were eligible for DACA will be able to participate.
I saw an amazing poll result from Fox News, a Fox News poll showing something like high 70s, almost 80% of people in their poll showed support for DACA. So basically, leave these kids alone, let them stay, figure out some way to let them stay in the United States.
That's right. And look.
And that's a poll I assume is somewhat biased, skewed. You assume they are. Maybe it wasn't. Yeah. Other polls showed a similar number.
Yeah. And President Trump knows that, which is why when he had the meeting at the White House, that he invited the cameras into the room.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Remember it well. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So when the cameras were rolling, he, knowing that that's the way the overwhelming majority of the American people feel, he talked about, let's get a deal. That's where he said, let's have a bill of love. That's where he said, okay, you all go out and come up with an agreement, Republicans and Democrats. And so everybody said, okay, Mr. President, you want a bipartisan agreement? We'll get you one. And they marched off and put it together. And, you know, then you had that incident at the White House where, you know, the president used those repulsive terms to, mm-hmm. you know, refer to certain immigrants.
And then he blew
up the whole DACA deal, even though we had, before he blew it up, we had the 60 votes, bipartisan Republicans and Democrats. So, look, we saw a similar incident at the White House on guns a couple weeks later where when the cameras were rolling, you know, the president was all about the need for more gun safety provisions, universal criminal background checks. Even talked to Senators Manchin and Toomey about adding the Dianne Feinstein provision to ban, you know, semi-automatic military assault weapons. And then, of course, the next night, the NRA came over for dinner,
right.
And we never heard another word.
And that
so,
was the end of that.
Again, the camera's rolling. The president knows the overwhelming majority of the public supports things like universal criminal background checks. But, you know, next day, the NRA actually sort of gave the president a statement for him.
You used the word sabotage a little while ago. I've been using that word a lot to describe what's going on in the government. If you look at cabinet-level positions, the people that the president has appointed to be secretaries, they seem to be people who despise or certainly oppose the mission of the departments that they're running. It seems to me that's what when I look at Scott Pruitt at the Environmental Protection Agency, Mick Mulvaney over at the Consumer Protection. What is it? The Consumer Protection?
Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Senator. And actually, he wants to change the name to make it even more difficult for me to give the name of it. Or Betsy DeVos. We've got now Ben Carson talking about increasing the rent or what people are expected to pay for public housing in the United States, for subsidized housing in the United States. And he's Secretary of HUD. That seems to be counter to the mission of HUD to me. They should be dealing with the problem of housing affordability, not making housing less affordable to people. So I use the word sabotage a lot. Is this some plot by the Koch brothers to get into government, people who will work counter to good government, to the things that we've built in this country over the years?
Well, the Koch brothers have certainly spent an awful lot of money trying to elect people who will do their bidding, and you do see their fingerprints on lots of the measures you just mentioned. When it comes to the Koch brothers, that's especially true at the Environmental Protection Agency, where Scott Pruitt got in there and immediately tried to dismantle a lot of the environmental protections. And by the way, for people in this region, proposed a budget in the first year of the Trump administration that zeroed out, like no dollars for the Chesapeake Bay protection program. And then in year two, proposed cutting it from $73 million a year to $7.3 million, so just 10%. And still don't get the message, because we, the Congress, on a bipartisan basis, I should say, have been restoring those funds. But it's just one very regional, local example of Scott Pruitt coming after the EPA. He actually sued the EPA when he was, as part of a group, when he was Attorney General in the state of Oklahoma, to prohibit the Bay States from enforcing EPA clean water standards in the Bay. So that's a big example. You mentioned Betsy DeVos. They cut some of the education funds for public schools and turned them into a private school voucher plan. That was what they proposed. They didn't get that in the end. And at HUD, you mentioned the latest proposals to, they proposed cutting the budget for public housing and for housing rental support.
Mm-hmm.
When that didn't work, they decided to increase
the rent.
The rent.
This is what they proposed.
Now, Mulvaney, though, this is the most recent Exhibit A, right? This agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, was established after the financial meltdown, to provide a watchdog for consumers, because a lot of people have been prey to these predatory loans. There have been a lot of games played in the Baltimore region. The city actually brought a lawsuit back in the day against Wells Fargo and was successful at showing that they were engaged in redlining. Mulvaney the other day, I think he thought it was a private conversation.
He's testifying in Congress.
Yeah, well, he's testifying in Congress, but he's also said on tape that, that when he was a member of Congress, in order to get into his office as a lobbyist, you had to contribute to his campaign. And so he was
otherwise he wouldn't talk to you.
That's right. He was urging a room full of banking interests and banking lobbyists to start spending more on campaign contributions to members of Congress so they could buy the influence they wanted. So this is the guy who's supposed to be heading the Consumer Financial Protection.
Didn't he go further and ask them for ideas on how he can neuter the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
He did. Right? And he's been out to neuter it from day one. When he was a member of Congress, he opposed it. He tried to destroy it. He tried to defund it. He called it a sick joke, and it actually has been a very important agency. And he, if he keeps doing what he's doing, is going to turn it into a sick joke, because he's going to try and defang it. And we need to make sure he is not successful. And don't be fooled. They did do a good thing recently. They levied a very large fine against Wells Fargo for all sorts of misdeeds and bad conduct from Wells Fargo. But it had been the previous administration, the previous
head.
They got that started. Who got to the bottom of that wrongdoing, and so what I worry about is people saying, "Oh well, look, they levied this big fine, and that was important," and at the same time, they're doing everything else to dismantle important consumer protections.
Well, it's a full frontal attack on government, on governance, and they're attacking from the flanks. It seems like every day there's some story about deregulation or some effort to roll back something that started with the Obama administration specifically. And that comes from the president, too. DACA, for instance.
Yeah.
There is no rationale for ending that program. It was a humane and wise solution that the president came up with temporarily that probably should be extended and made formally into law. But, why did Trump blow it up?
This is a direct attack on things that had been working well, that he did not have to blow up in any way, and just chose to sort of pull the trigger on that. And now, is kind of shedding crocodile tears and saying, "Oh, you guys got to go fix this. I don't know why the Democrats in the Congress aren't fixing this." Well, we're trying to fix it, as I discussed earlier. It never had to be broken if he hadn't broken it. And when we talk about their attacks on governance and regulations, remember, these are rules put in place to protect the public. Like at the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, it's to protect the public from, for example, predatory lending and some of the payday loan sharks. It's to make sure that if you are wronged by a big bank, that you have some recourse. And those are the kind of rules that they're in the process of striking out at the EPA. We're talking about clean water, clean air, and things that help people stay healthy.
Plus, if you don't mind me using the term sleaze factor, you have a sleaze factor associated with Scott Pruitt now, above and beyond what he's doing at the EPA. And so you've asked for his resignation, haven't you?
I have, because beyond the fact that he is out to undermine the mission of the EPA, he is engaged in all of this bad conduct that really betrays the public trust.
What's the smelliest part for you?
Oh, my goodness.
The association with lobbyists?
It's hard to know where to start. But, I mean, first of all, he abused public funding to sort of build himself special amenities over at his office. And then he got a sweetheart deal on his rent in his D.C. apartment from the spouse of somebody who worked for as a coal lobbyist or energy lobbyist. Mm-hmm. Anyway, there's a whole litany of things where it's very clear that he's violated the public trust. So that's why, you know, beyond fundamentally disagreeing with his policies because of that, you know, violation of public trust, that combination of things, you know, that's why I called upon him to step down.
One more thing I wanted to talk to you about, the combination of the tax cuts in December and the spending package that was approved in March with a huge increase in defense spending and even more domestic spending. Isn't what you expected for those who seem to be anti-government or want a smaller government to go this way. But they got what they wanted with the tax cuts, and then that was followed by the omnibus spending bill. And now we've got the Congressional Budget Office saying expect $1 trillion deficits each year for the coming decade and increasing the national debt to some $30 trillion or something like that. I mean, this is
yes,
amazing.
it is astounding. And, you know, before I was in the Senate, I was the senior Democrat on the House Budget Committee. And Paul Ryan, before he became Speaker, was the chairman of that committee.
And,
he used to lecture very self-righteously about the deficit and debt. And I actually agree with concerns about the deficit and debt and have been one of the folks who's been looking for ways and proposed ways to get a handle on it, which is why it was so hypocritical when that tax bill passed that according to the Congressional Budget Office, and these are the green eye shade guys, these are the nonpartisan experts, they've concluded that it doesn't come close to paying for itself, that tax cut, which is the claim that was made, that it will add close to $2 trillion, add $2 trillion to our debt over the next 10 years, and already a big debt. If you look at that tax bill, most of the $2 trillion that we're borrowing from ourselves and our kids and grandkids went straight to the bottom lines of very big corporations and very wealthy people. And the smaller tax cuts that will go to some other Americans will expire, whereas the corporate tax cuts
are permanent.
Go on forever. One aside on that I should mention, which was a very revealing finding by the Congressional Budget Office just in the last couple weeks, is that if you look at the increased economic activity from the tax cut and you look at the additional income generated in the economy from that tax cut, over the 10-year period, on average, 47% of that additional income into the bank accounts of foreign investors. And at the end of the 10-year period, 71% of that additional income generated into the bank accounts of foreign investors. Partly because you have a already large share and a growing share of foreigners who have, you know, stocks here. So when you mm-hmm. give a big windfall to the corporations, it goes into their pockets. And partly because of that $2 trillion we're borrowing, foreign interests are buying the debt. So the interest payments that our country will be making are going into their bank accounts. So it was an astounding—
Do you understand how they arrived at that conclusion?
Yeah, there were these two pieces to it. And one piece was the fact that as of today— you have, you know, foreign interests actually own 35% of U.S. stock. I don't know if you remember, but when the Norwegian leader was here many, many months ago, during a press conference, she turned to President Trump and thanked him for the benefits flowing to Norway from the tax cut. American dollars, you know, our tax
yeah.
those are flowing into their sovereign wealth fund and other Norwegian stockholders, and that's true around the world now. So that and that will grow over 35% over time. And the other is if you look at who holds our overall debt, mm-hmm. a lot of it is, and a growing amount will be to foreign interests. So they will get the benefit of those interest payments. There were a number of other; those were some of the major factors. But it was an astounding finding. You mentioned the budget agreement. Look, My view is that we needed some increase on the national security defense side, but that it went given the fact that you know, we're already spending more than like the next 10 countries combined, and that most of those 10 countries are actually our NATO allies. We didn't need to be spending that much more. I did support investments in things like education and housing, and again in defense as well, but just not at that that level.
Yeah, it seems like a big con to me. They throw out some stories about people getting bonuses as a result of corporations getting the tax cut. I did see a poll that suggested that the people aren't buying it, though, that the tax cuts aren't that popular. Actually, Americans are kind of take a kind of a sour view toward it.
Well, you know, the American people are onto this scam, con, because the initial views of the American public were already very skeptical. I mean, when the tax plan first came out, people saw it for exactly what it was, that this was a big tax cut for major corporations and very wealthy folks.
And the Republicans then tried to sell it as a middle class
tax cut. Yeah, they tried to sell it as a middle class tax cut. And then what happened is, after it went into effect, you had, as you said, you had some of these big companies announcing one-time bonuses. And so, you know, the public began to say, okay, maybe this is working. And then people began to see that wearing off, and they also started to look at the fine print on the bonuses. So, for example, I think it was Walmart announced $1,000 bonuses. So you thought, okay, everyone at Walmart got a $1,000 bonus. Well, it turned out you had to have been there for a long, long period of time to get that full bonus. And the other thing to remember about this, Dan, is that these are one-time bonuses, which is, you know, fine, but here's what they promised. In speech after speech on the floor of the Senate, Republican senators, like the president, said that people are going to get a $4,000 pay raise. Now, a pay raise for $4,000 this year means $40,000 over 10 years. That's not happening. Mm-hmm. People are not seeing this. And so what they are seeing is the huge amount of money being devoted to stock buybacks, which are just monies going to corporate executives, the CEOs, and those foreign stockholders and others. And the figure, and this has been well established, 40 times more money has been spent by corporations on stock buybacks than has been spent on new investment in plant and equipment or any of these bonuses. 40 times. And this is just since the beginning of the year.
We're heading into May 2018. What's your biggest concern about this president?
My biggest concern has to do with the instability of this president and the chaos in the White House, especially as it relates to our national security. This president's got an awful agenda when it comes to domestic politics. It's, in my view, tilted toward the very wealthy and the special interests, despite the way he campaigned. Right, he campaigned as he was a rich guy, but he was for the common man. All his policies, we've talked about Mulvaney at the CFPB. I mean, you know, with the bank lobbyists saying, you guys got to buy more influence so we can screw consumers. The tax cut that goes to, so his policies have been terrible. But I think our republic is strong enough to weather that storm. I do worry about somebody who seems to be this unstable when it comes to some major foreign policy challenges. Now, look, we hope for the best in the case of the Korea summit, and we have had bipartisan support for putting maximum economic pressure on the North Koreans. In fact, I had a bill that we still need to get passed that passed the banking committee, but it would actually insert more pressure, especially on Chinese and other banks who are conduits in some cases for the North Koreans. So we're all together on that. We just need to watch this very carefully because verification is key. And the North Koreans have previously promised that they would denuclearize. And look where we are today.
What about the Iran deal? Mike Pompeo is the Secretary of State now. You voted against his nomination. But he's taking a hard line, talking tough like the president does on possibly pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal.
This would be a big mistake for the United States and our allies to unilaterally pull out of this agreement. This is an agreement that cuts off the paths that Iran has to develop nuclear weapons. We cannot allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon. And there are very stringent verification provisions in place so that if they try to cheat, then we have time to react. If you get rid of this agreement, we will be blind, we won't have the verification, and the Iranians will be free to develop a nuclear program. And by the way, that's why all of our allies, NATO allies and others, have said to the United States, don't do this. You will isolate the United States, not Iran.
Chris Van Hollen, thank you very much.
Good to be with you. Thanks.
Chris Van Hollen is Maryland's junior senator. You can find links to the stories on the subjects we discussed in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. Your thoughts are always welcome by email, Twitter, or on Facebook. Please tell your friends about the show if you get a chance and review us on iTunes. For the producers, Steve Early and Queen Kelly in the Baltimore Sun Newsroom, I'm Dan Rodericks. Thanking you for listening to Roughly Speaking, and we'll see you again soon.
I like that.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at 6080 Falls Road, located at the intersection of Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. More information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.